its moment to touch them. The time for subtlety was over. A rune would need to be carved. The ordinary people knew runes, scratched symbols that allowed them to record simple messages or list things. But to the witches, they were much more than that. More even than charms for amulets or to guard a chest, as some of the healers and wise women of the farmsteads knew them to be. They were living things that took root in the mind and grew within it, changing it utterly, feeding on sanity and blossoming into magic. Rune carving was not something the witches took lightly. Runes were powerful sources of magic given by Odin, or rather taken in pain and anguish and willful madness from the dark god by the earliest women who had retreated to the mountain. Generations before, there had been just one witch. She had sat alone in the caves, her mind falling through the dark, until her pain had matched the dead lord's when he hung on the tree for 9 days and nights, pierced by the spear and chilled by the moon at the Well of Wisdom. Her reward was a rune that meant daylight, and though it had no name, it shone in her mind and warmed her bones like the sun on a summer's afternoon. The presence of the rune inside her gave her the power to heal the people of the mountain and the ability to reveal glimpses of the future to them. In return, they had sent her 3 girls to train. One of them, drowned, starved, and frozen for year after year, met the dead god by the deep pool and was given a rune that sparkled like bright water. The minds of men fell open to her, and she began to dream the dreams of children in faraway places, hear jealous whispers flowing through the mountain passes, and feel the coursing currents of love and hate that washed over the farmsteads. Another took a different path to knowledge. She dug her own grave, and the sisters sealed her in with a rock. As her sanity collapsed, she had felt the god lying next to her in that tiny space, touched the rope at the god's neck, and felt his body cold and lifeless next to her. Her rune seemed to grow and wither in her mind, now obscured by earth and weeds, now exhumed and vibrant. When she was lifted from the ground, she was scarcely breathing, but she had won the most valuable rune of all. Now she knew the secrets of inheritance and how magic can be given as a gift. From that moment on, death could not take the power of the runes from the sisters. Each could build on the knowledge of her teachers. Progress was possible. The witches grew more powerful, generation after generation keeping what they had and building on their knowledge until there were 24 sisters of the inner circle, each the guardian, nurturer, and expression of a different rune. Now, though, there was a 25th witch. She was known to Orthon as Gulveig, the Witch Queen, and to some of the local people as Huldra. But the sisters never called her that, or anything. She had been brought to the tunnels as a baby, destined, according to divination, to take on the rune of daylight. But when the witches started to work with the girl, it became plain it was already within her, seeming to shine from the darkness from her first meditations, to rustle like the wind in a full-leafed tree in the minds of all the witches who looked at her. This was a puzzle for the sisters, because it normally took years of suffering and denial to make the rune manifest, that and the death of the sister within whom it currently dwelled. At 2 years old, the girl was put to further agonies, and observed. A rune seemed to spill from her, silver like the sea on a moonlit night, then another which twinkled like ice in the morning sun, and then a third, which seemed more a feeling than a vision. Harsh prickles on the skin, with a deep, blustery cold. And a fourth, with the scent of wild fruit. A fifth, like hunger. A sixth, with the glint of gold. A seventh, that smelled of roses and blood. And an eighth, with the sound of the wind in sails. By the end of the girl's third year, all the 24 runes that the sisters spent their lives expressing, dreaming and using for their power were in the girl. She represented a new stage in the witch's evolution. Previously, the queen had only held the daylight rune, that of the first witch. Gulveig had them all. Through her early years, her ritual sufferings had propelled her mind on travels with the hanged god through dry tombs in arid lands where the dead seemed to claw at her from their crumbling graves, to mires and peat bogs where she had seen the fresh pink skin of the newly drowned whose faces seemed to implore her for help as they sank, to battles where she heard the whispered names of lovers and children on the lips of dying men and where she picked the shrieking runes from their fingers. It was said she was mad, but had the farmers and warriors of the valleys known what she had been through, they would have marvelled she stayed so sane. Reading the portents of rock, wind and water, Gulveig knew something extraordinary was happening. The foreboding that filled the caves, the heavy air, the sense of frustration waiting to break, told her she had no choice. She had to carve a rune, to force the future into the physical realm, to make it something that could be handled, discussed, and, ultimately, manipulated. For this, she descended to the lower caves, where the rocks were stained glowing reds and greens, and the damp and the cold gave way to a heat that seemed to pour from the earth. She took with her a small piece of cured leather that had once been a chieftain's belt, and a pin that had held his cloak at his neck. Then she stayed on her own for a season. No one brought her food. The water she had was only what she licked from the cave walls. There was no light except the phosphorescence of the rock, and no presence but her own. At the end of her ordeal, the sisters came and carried her from the cave. She had written nothing, and it was clear a greater trial was needed. The sinkhole at the bottom of the ghost caves was not a natural phenomenon, though no one could recall who had dug it. It was about an arm span wide at the top, but narrowed as it descended 10 or 12 times the height of a man, until anyone falling into it would have been stuck fast like a stopper in a bottle. The shaft cut across a powerful underground stream which entered through a fissure as wide as a fist at the top and left through another at the bottom. The result was that, when the witch was lowered by rope into the hole, she was immersed in flowing water up to her neck. She knew that for the ritual to succeed, she would need to spend 9 days there. The first 3 days had been dark and agonizing. She was, after all, human. No one who had grown up without her training could have endured it. Since she was a tiny girl, she had been subjected to terrible long fasts and meditations. She had consumed strange mushrooms and been confined and buried like the dead, spent nights naked beneath the moon on frozen hillsides when only the power of the mind stands between life and death. So the witch queen did endure it, clawing her way out of her humanity in pain and anguish. On the fourth day, the torture had divorced her mind from her physical body, and the lights had come on. Dwarfs stood in the darkness, offering her gold and jewels and a ship that seemed built of something like pearl, but was, she knew, made of dead men's nails. It was all hers, if only she would call to the sisters to pull her from the water. On the fifth day, the walls around her flamed with green and purple lights, and the spirits of the rock tried to lift her from the pool, but she remained. On the sixth day, her ancestors were at her side, the ghosts who gave the caves their name, 100 queens, all less powerful than her, but all part of her. She was the sum of the whole, she knew. All the dead queens were there, some naked and smeared in muds and vegetable dyes, some finer than she was, calling, jabbering, singing and weeping in the dark. They begged her to give up, spat at her, tried to rip her from the water, but she would not relent. The witch queen was on the way to her answer. On the seventh day, there were voices, and she knew the gods were near. On the eighth day, there was just blackness, an absence of thought, nothing, as she stood on the edge of death. Then, on the ninth day, she was back in the pool, just as she had been the moment she went in. The flowing water had stopped, and she felt warm. None of the other sisters was around her, nor any of the servant boys, but the phosphorescence of the rocks seemed even brighter. In the cave, it was like daylight. A voice came echoing from tunnels that stretched away from her.
"Do you know what they did to me? Do you know what they did?"
Though the witch queen rarely spoke, she could understand these words that resonated as much in her mind as in her ears. An odor of burning seeped into her consciousness, not a pleasant smell at all, nothing like wood or straw on fire. It was closer to hair.
"See what they did to me! See what they did!"
She climbed out of the sinkhole and walked down to the lower caves, and then lower still, following the burning smell and the voice.
"I am blind! I am blind!"
the voice spoke again. The witch moved on down. The caves became smaller. She had never been in them before, and sensed they were not part of the real world, but some place accessible only by magic. She could taste the smoke in her throat, thick and bitter, and the voice became louder. Then, in the dim light, she could make out a figure. At first, she thought he was shrouded in mist, but as she drew nearer, she could see something between steam and smoke hissing from his thrashing body. The man was naked and tied to a rock with bloody and glutinous ropes, while above him snakes of vivid purple, green, and yellow writhed, dripping venom onto his face and into his eyes. His features were swollen, bruised, and black. His tongue was mottled blue and white, and the poison sizzled on his flesh. His pale skin was burned into welts, and his red hair singed to patches. He was screaming and howling, tearing at his bonds, but he couldn't get them off. The witch had practiced enough minor magics to recognize the fetters for what they were. They were entrails. Suddenly, for the first time since before she had joined her sisters underground when she was small, the witch queen felt like the child she was. The presence of this tormented man terrified her. This, she knew, was a creature even the gods feared. Next to him was a silver bowl. The witch came forward and picked it up, collecting the venom before it fell onto the god's face. She knew now who it was. Loki, lord of lies, betrayer of the gods, bane of heroes, but sometimes, occasionally, friend of man.
"I send my mind forth in torment. I travel the nine worlds in agony, witch. Do you see what they did to me, the slaughter-fond gods? They who have taken numberless heads in battle just because I took one little life. Who could love Baldur, the perfect god, the stinking lickspittle? Not so perfect he couldn't die, eh?"
The witch had hardly spoken since she had been a girl. Her only language what she picked up from initiates and servants who came to the caves late, aged 7 or 8 at the oldest. So she said nothing now.
"You have given me something. You have granted me respite. What is it you want?"
He turned his head to hers. Even during her long training, in her conversations with the rock spirits, with the dwarfs and the elves, she had never seen such a terrible sight. His whole face resembled a blood blister ready to burst. The bowl was overflowing, her fingers swelling as the venom splashed on them. She flung the steaming liquid to the floor, but before she could return the bowl to its place, the venom of the snakes fell once more on Loki, singeing and blackening his flesh. The guard screamed and vomited, and the witch shoved the bowl back under the flow of poison.
"Twice you've given me respite from this torment. What is it you want?"
"For the first respite you gave me, I will tell you that you and your sisters are not long from death. You have grown too strong in magic and knowledge, and he, the lore-jealous Lord Odin, will strike at you. Odin is coming for you in your realm on Earth. He has taken human form and is upon you, in the flesh, mighty in his corrosive magics." This puzzled the witch. She was close to Odin. She had looked for the god many times, and it was he she had expected to find through the ordeal of water. Loki went on, coughing and retching from the effects of the poison.
"For the second respite you granted me, I will tell you that you have it in your hands to avoid this fate. He does not yet sense himself. The god is not yet awake. He does not know who he is. Act quickly and strike at him. There are two boys, Fire and Frost. One to live, one to die."
The bowl overflowed again. Gulveig cast aside the poison and replaced it above the screaming god. Now her own arms were swollen and burned, her fingers numb. Only her training helped her ignore the pain.
"No one has ever stayed to offer me 3 bowls of respite," said Loki. "And for this service, I grant you your answer. At the end of the world, Odin will fight with the wolf and die. You must bring the wolf to Earth as Odin is on Earth. Make the spirit of the wolf come to flesh in a man as the god has come to flesh. This is your rune and your guide. It will kill a god. Take it from one who knows."
A thought sprang into the witch's mind. "Show me my enemy." But then the steam of the venom obscured her sight. The acrid smell choked her, and she dropped the bowl. Darkness descended. For the first time in 9 days, she cried out, and the boys threw down a loop of rope to pull her from the stream. The witch hacked and coughed out the water from her lungs as she was hauled from the sinkhole. The boys moved back, and the sisters came to her. They didn't bring food, fire, blankets, or medicine, but the scrap of belt and the brooch pin. The witch looked down at her fingers. They were swollen and blackened. Despite her pain, she took up the brooch and carved a rune into the leather. Then she threw it to the floor and collapsed onto her hands and knees, panting and retching. The circle of sisters looked down at the rune and felt a muttering thought of disquiet pass among them. Half of them saw it. It was not one of the 24 runes given by Odin that they had expected to see. It was a new rune, something that hadn't been given to a witch queen for 8 generations. These witches knew it was something special, though they struggled to grasp its importance. To some, the resonance of the symbol was only slightly clearer than their existing forewarning of momentous change, which had come to them in the idea of a storm. It signified a thunderbolt. They took the feeling of the rune into their minds and turned it over. Then one saw the mouth of a river between 2 hills. Another saw a church on a hill and knew something important was inside it. 2 boys, each in his way important to them. A long magic was needed, taking years to make, but lasting years too. What were the boys? One was the subject of the spell, the other something else. What? They couldn't see. A helper? No. A sacrifice? No, something different. The other boy was like the extinguished candle, like the bowl of rainwater, like 100 other things the witches used to work their magic. A medium for something? Not quite. Then they saw it. He was an ingredient. Others saw a different meaning in the rune, one that it would bear down the centuries until one day someone gave it a name. Wolfsangel. This was not a word the sisters would have recognized, though its sense was clear to them. Wolf trap. They saw themselves flying beneath a heavy moon as a smudge of starlings, to settle at midnight on the roof of King Orthon's hall, to call to the sleeping king and tell him that his wife would never give him a boy, and that if he needed counsel, then the witches would receive him. They saw the further future, too. A girl on a hillside. She had bright blonde hair. She was important, too, they could tell, but none of them could see how. Some of the witches who huddled around the rune saw the symbol on its side. These sisters felt a chill, as ordinary people do when they hear wolves in the hills. The rune's resonance went through their minds like a hungry howl. It said, "Werewolf." That was the point of the magic, what the two brothers were for, so that the wolf god could take form inside a man. The witch queen was at the point of blacking out, unable to connect to her sisters in her normal way. Exhausted, her consciousness balled in on itself like a child left alone in the dark. She tapped at the rune and, her voice cracking, she spoke.
"Protector," she said.
Chapter 7. What was lost? The beauty of the summer seemed to fill him to bursting. The fjord, sparkling with a light that was almost painful to look at. The meadow flowers among the green grass, like flames beneath the sun. Away over the hillside, a man was calling,
"Varley! Varley! Where are you, you goat?"
"He's supposed to be hunting murmuring birds with me, but he can't even find where I am," said Varley, looking at the man from a hollow in the ground. He was about 13, ready to go raiding almost, but still laughing like a little child.
"You'll be beaten," said the girl with him.
She was the same age, in a full skirt. She was pale, had long blonde plaits, and in her hair was a whalebone comb. Next to her was a basket of herbs that she'd been collecting for her mother.
"It'll be worth it," he said, and kissed her. It was the first time, just a peck.
"Get off me," said Adisla, standing up. "Bragi! Bragi! He's over here!"
And the big man had come running.
"Prince Varley," he said, "you make things very difficult for me at times. Where is your spear? Where is your bow?"
"I'm sure they're around here somewhere," said Varley. "I left them down by the stream when I saw Adisla."
Bragi, a battle-scarred old warrior of around 35, shook his head.
"Those weapons must never leave your side, you know that. When the time comes for you to go raiding, and it is awful soon, what are you going to do? Leave your shield and sword in the ship as soon as you see a pretty girl?"
"I think that highly likely," said Adisla.
"You, young lady, can keep your mouth shut. Look at you. Pale as a princess. A farm girl like you should show more signs of honest toil."
"This conversation could be regarded as toil enough for a lifetime," said Adisla.
"I've had enough of this," said Bragi. "I'm going to speak to your mother."
The girl shrugged in a do-what-you-like way. Bragi pointed his finger at her.
"I make no bones about it," he said. "I blame you for what has happened to him. Before he started ignoring the court and spending his time with farmers' daughters, he showed some promise at arms. Now his weapons lie neglected, and he spends his days at your mother's house, whittling away his time in games and talk. The son of Orthun the White Wolf, a Cinderbiter.
Varley laughed. He'd always wondered about that particular expression. Did Cinderbiters really bite cinders? If so, he wasn't one. But if it meant he was happiest at the hearth, sitting beside Adisla and listening to the stories of the farmers, then it was true, he was a Cinderbiter.
"I haven't cast a spell on him," said Adisla.
"No," said Bragi. "But you may as well have. Come on, we're going to see your ma."
It was a stiff walk up the valley to Adisla's farm, and hot work in the sun. Bragi made Varley carry both packs and all their weapons as punishment for running off while hunting, and when he saw the prince wasn't encumbered enough, added a few rocks to the bags for good measure. Adisla's mother was Disa, a noted healer who lived in a house above the growing port of Ekund in Rogaland, home of the Rigir people. In Varley's time there, it had blossomed from 8 to 12 houses, and so was considered a large settlement. Varley had been sent to Ekund by his father Orthun 5 years before to guarantee the treaty between the Horda and the Rigir that had ended a bloody war. Bragi had been sent with him to see to his training in hunting and swordsmanship, but it had become apparent very quickly that the old retainer and the prince were temperamentally unsuited. The only time they seemed to get on was sailing Vali's little scute around the coast, hunting for seals and fishing. Neither ever said much on these trips. Varley was too engrossed in the sun and the water, the feel of the small boat, as it moved with the wind like an animal. Bragi didn't speak, because he had a superstition that it drove the fish away. Varley was sweating by the time he reached the house, which was no more than a large hut. He was glad that it was high summer, where time began to lose definition, and night was just a sliver of darkness in the broad wash of the day. Even though it was late, the sun was still high, and down in the river that skirted the farms, people were still bathing, as they did every Saturday. As soon as he got the chance, he would join them. He laughed as he remembered the first time he'd met Adisla. He'd been at Ekund a week when he'd heard a commotion. She had gone to the bottom of the river and held her breath until her mother had plunged in after her on a mission of rescue, only for Adisla to pop up behind her, giggling wildly. Even then, 5 summers before, no one could swim like Adisla. Her brothers called her the Seal, the first of a series of ever-evolving nicknames they had for her, not all of which were particularly flattering. Seals were known as dogs of the sea, so she had been called Garm for a while, after the hound that lives in hell, and then, after Disa had objected to that, Woofy. Varley sometimes called her that himself when he was with her family, but he always used her real name when they were alone. Varley loved this place. The smoke with its promise of food issuing from the vent on the roof, chickens running around his feet, and dogs coming out to bark at him in greeting, not warning. He had a place in the long hall of King Forkbeard in the port below, but since he'd come to Rogaland, this was where Varley had always felt most at home, and he'd spent as much time at Ma Disa's as he had at the court. "Hello, Ma!" Varley shouted, and a woman taking drying herbs from the low roof of the hut turned to see them approach.
"Been up to your usual tricks, I see," said Disa.
Unlike her daughter, she was as brown as a baked barleycorn, having given up applying the lotions that kept her pretty and pale at about the same time she had ceased caring if she was attractive to men. Disa had divorced her husband, and, since he was heavy with his fists, the assembly had voted that she be allowed to keep his farm. He'd died the next year on a raid that was intended to restore his fortune, and she hadn't been sorry. Now she was queen of her house, which teemed with her own children and those of the surrounding small farms. On the summer evenings, Varley would sit outside with Adisla and her family, playing the board game King's Table, telling and listening to stories and eating the food from Deesa's incomparable hearth. He even managed something of an education there. Old man Barth, Deesa's only thrall, had been captured in a skirmish with the Danes. Vali was fascinated to learn his language, and spent a long time talking to the slave about his homeland and customs. Barth had been a slave in Denmark, and, it turned out, regarded Deesa as a better mistress than the Danish Jarl who had owned him before. In the winter, everyone would cram into the tiny smoky hut, eating baked roots, salted fish, and laughing until they couldn't laugh any more. Her brothers, particularly Leikr and the youngest, Manni, were very dear to him, and were his friends in hunting, play, and conversation.
"Ma," said Bragi, "I need to talk to you about your daughter."
"Oh, yes."
"I want you to forbid her from seeing the prince."
"I'm not in the habit of forbidding my children anything," said Deesa. "But I'll talk to her."
"You can't call her a child. She's 13 years old, at least. There are girls of her age a year married, and all the better for it."
"What appears to be the problem?"
Bragi threw his hands into the air and gave a sound like a hiss, as if the bubbling cauldron of complaint he kept inside himself had finally boiled over. Still, he tried to maintain a grip on his politeness, to temper his language and to use fine words to emphasize the difference between himself and the farmers around him.
"The problem is this. I am an oath-sworn retainer of King Orthon the White Wolf. I am a veteran of 23 raids. I stood side by side with the king as we faced the Geats at the Orestrond, hopelessly outnumbered, ready for death. With that dread lord, I cut my way through 20 of the enemy, and made the ocean red with sword sweat to reach our boats."
Deesa was having to suppress a smile. Behind Bragi, Vali was miming the story. He'd heard it all 100 times, and in 100 ways. Boasted before the drinking hall, whispered around a campfire, shouted at him as an example to greater effort. He knew the words by heart.
"I am a warrior, and I was honoured and delighted to be offered the post of bodyguard and tutor to this boy. I find, however, that it is increasingly a burden of loathsome proportions, loathsome proportions. I feel like Loki, tied to the rock and my eyes filled with venom. He is ungovernable, madam, and your daughter is to blame."
"In what way?"
"I curse the day he laid eyes on her. At first it was an innocent friendship of children, but in the last year he has had no time for hunting, none for weapons training. His father had the very unusual idea of allowing him work in the smithy, in order that he should know everything about weapons, from their time as rocks of the earth to their effect on an enemy shield. He is absent from the forge. He is absent from the assembly meetings where Forkbeard was to teach him statecraft. He is absent when I call for him to test him with sword and spear. He is absent everywhere, madam, other than at your daughter's side, where he is, very annoyingly, present."
Deesa shrugged exactly the same shrug as her daughter had made earlier.
"I can't tell her who she can and can't see. Nothing can come of it. He's already spoken for, isn't he?"
"Not by me," said Vali.
Bragi gave him a look, very similar, thought Vali, to the one he must have given Geat number 20 on the way to the ships.
"He's betrothed to Forkbeard's daughter," said Deesa, as if that ended all debate.
"The fact that I don't want to marry her seeming a very little consequence in the arrangement," said Vali.
"Not very little," said Bragi. "None. Madam, Ma, this dalliance between your daughter and the prince must stop."
Deesa just spread her arms out.
"What do you expect me to do?"
He's come here since he was a little boy.
He is a little boy no longer. Have you any idea how the king would feel if any issue should emerge from this?
He's never touched me, said Adisla.
Not through want of trying, said Bragi. Look, madam, forbid this association. If you do not, I could have the king command it.
Now Mardisa frowned.
All I owe the king is a portion of my income and my son's in the wars. I'm not a member of his sworn bodyguard to be bossed and bullied. Who me and mine choose as our friends is none of his business.
Everything is the king's business.
Deesa took the last of the herbs from the roof and wiped a hand on her pinafore.
Not so. The law supports no interference from him in the affairs of free people. He won't tell me who my children can have as friends.
These are not children, madam. Varley is a man of 13 summers, and is likely to become king in his own right soon.
And who can tell him what to do? Said Deesa.
Bragi let out a growl, collected his weapons, and headed back down the hill. The old man was a figure of fun to Varley, but the following week he would be glad Bragi was at his side when, for the first time, he went raiding. Chapter 8 Fury. The ship had been in the great hall for repair, and they'd had to pull it down to the water. Everything had seemed more intense than normal to him that morning. The creak of the cords, the rumbling of the keel on the logs, the acrid smell of the pitch on the hull, the heaving song of the warriors.
Bend your backs, boys. Don't be slow. Over and over the ocean we go. But our swords will dance on our enemy's shields like the glimmering fish on the sea's blue fields. So bend your backs, boys. Don't be slow. Over and over the ocean we go.
He pulled as hard as he could.
Don't leave all your strength on the shore, an old man said to him,
and Varley had to smile to himself. He saw himself as he was, a young boy trying to show himself manly through his effort, frightened of the greater test of battle to come. The self-knowledge, though, did nothing to lessen the overwhelming nature of the experience. The morning cold was sharp, the blue of the ocean dazzling, and the cries of the seabirds made an echoing cavern of his mind. She had been there then, and this time he hadn't needed to steal a kiss from her. She fixed a bright purple sprig of betony to his cloak.
"It fights evil," she said. "And it will keep you safe."
"I'll still take my shield," he said.
"It might be wise."
"Adisla?"
"Yes, Varley?"
She
put her hand to his lips.
"Don't say it,"
she said.
"Why?" "It brings bad luck. If you let the gods know you value something, they will take it away from you. Come back to me. You don't need to tell me how you feel."
King Forkbeard had not missed their intimacies, but chose to pretend to. His daughter Ragnar stood at his side, 6 years old, and playing with a distaff. Varley looked at Forkbeard, and then back to Adisla.
"He's hoping I'm killed," he said. "But in a nice way," said Adisla. "He'd prefer Orthon had sent him a different sort of prince. Tougher, more manly, more bad-tempered, that sort of thing. Let's hope I'm alive to disappoint him. If you're not, you'll be in Odin's halls, drunk for all time in the company of heroes."
Varley rolled his eyes.
"Listening to the likes of Bragi banging on about their exalted deeds of slaughter. Drunk for all time? You'd need to be to stand that."
"That's sacrilege," she said, laughing.
"Who cares? The gods are afraid of us. That's what my father says."
"Everyone's afraid of your father," she said. Can you imagine it? Sozzled, with him glowering at me across the mead bench forever. I'll die a coward if it means I can be with you.
Adisla blushed.
Don't go soppy on me just because you're scared, she said. I shall be your Valkyrie, urging you on. Win glory, my darling, win glory. Return in triumph or not at all.
She had put on an upper-class accent and pretended to dab at her eye with a cloth, just as the noble women did when their husbands went raiding. Vali knew her very well and understood that her light-hearted mood was for show. He smiled at her and touched her hair. The tears came into her eyes, and he could not face them down. Now he turned to the boat, splashing out into the water, shouldering the small chest that would be his seat for the journey. He heaved it into the longship, then climbed on board and picked it up. His feet stumbled on the spars and ballast stones of the undecked vessel as he looked for his oar place, trying to look calm, trying to look as though he knew what he was doing. There was no one he knew on the boat, and no one he even recognized. He had a place on the Drakkar, a sleek and slim warship with a carved bear's head snarling from the prow, as befitted his status as one of the warrior class. Alongside were two fat-bellied knars, trading vessels that, empty, sat much higher in the water. They were for the plunder. On those boats were the farmers Vali knew. This made him slightly nervous. Normally, the way men recognized friend from enemy in battle was that they were put into groups from the same area who knew each other by sight. Among strangers and in the heat of a fight, he might be mistaken for a foe. He looked around him as he moved down the ship, determined that he at least would recognize the faces of the men he was fighting with. Each man at an oar was huge, his hair and beard unkempt and shaggy, his clothes dirty, with a stale smell coming off him. Many bore so many tattoos they seemed almost blue. Vali glanced at them and tried not to use their shoulders to balance as he went forward. There were mutterings. Vali couldn't tell if they were directed at him, at each other, or were just ravings. It was an underbreath babble. The words were half-formed. He could only just make them out. When he did, he wished he hadn't.
Unmanly. Frightened. Kill the cowards. Aye, kill, smite, shit and piss. Know they've been in a fight. Kill all. None alive. Burn the earth. Burn the earth.
He glanced at their eyes. They seemed focused on nothing, red-rimmed, like people who hadn't slept for days, staring balefully ahead. Some of the men wore the pelts of animals about them or on their heads, and some were near naked, despite the dawn cold. Vali didn't care for their company at all. At the back of the boat, being sealed into barrels or tied to the stern, were their weapons, axes and spears. He'd seen only one sword. These were not rich men. Unlike themselves, however, the weapons were well cared for, the axe heads honed to brilliant silver, the spears as sharp as bodkins. There was a hand on his shoulder.
"Here's your oar, son."
Bragi had come up behind him, and Vali was glad to see him. Vali put his chest down and sat on it. Bragi climbed in across from him, put down his chest too, sat on it sideways, and lightly punched the prince's arm.
"Now you might wish you'd paid attention to what I had to say about sword, shield, and spear."
Vali, his flippancy driven off by nerves, just smiled back. Bragi put his hand on Vali's shoulder.
"Don't worry, Prince, you'll be fine. Though if you'd listen to me more, you'd be finer. I got you a place on the best boat."
Vali leaned away, resenting the intimacy.
"None of my kinsmen are here."
"No. But you are among the best warriors in 20 kingdoms, said Bragi.
These men?
Yes.
Berserks?
Yes. From the northern cult of Odin the Frenzied, working solely for transport.
And the plunder they can take, said Vali.
Only up to a point. They'll take plunder for sure. But it's not their main aim, said Bragi. It might be better if it was.
What do they fight for?
To fight. Look at them. Each man here has been on many raids, but are they rich? No. Do they have many slaves? No. They aren't concerned by such things.
They want no plunder.
Yes, a little. But this is why they're useful to Forkbeard. Their reward is the scrap itself. He gets some good fighters, and they don't bother too much about the booty.
They sound insane, said Vali.
Maybe they are. But you can learn from them, nevertheless. You'll see how a man conducts himself in war.
Vali said nothing. To him it was as important how a man conducted himself in peace. To sit muttering curses while bleary-eyed through who knew what concoctions of mushrooms and herbs was the act of an idiot, not a hero. They were 3 days from the fight, according to Bragi. The berserks were simmering before they had set off. What would they be like in sight of the enemy's spears? Still, he was interested to see if they lived up to their reputation as invulnerable and fearless. Could it really be true that weapons didn't injure them? Looking around the ship, he was glad he was fighting with them rather than against them. The wind was up, which was why they were sailing. The longship's sail billowed and snapped as it was unfurled, as if impatient to get going. Its design had been chosen in his honour, black with a snarling wolf's head picked out in white. Vali looked up at his father's symbol, the symbol of everything he was supposed to become, in fact, everything he was supposed already to be. It made him shiver to think of the weight of responsibility he carried. His musings were interrupted by a boot in the back.
Move your arse! I need to stretch my legs!
He turned around to see a huge man in a thick tunic, a white bearskin over his arm. A deep groove ran from the top of his head over his eye socket and down into his cheek. Clearly he had been on the wrong end of an axe at some time in his life. Every inch of his body seemed covered in thickly drawn tattoos. Scenes of destruction and battle, the coiling world serpent around his right arm, the wolf fighting Odin on his left, the 3 interlocking triangles that made up that god's symbol below his left eye, and many other illustrations of animal figures, gallows and weapons all over his face and upper body. Vali's knife and sword were at the bottom of his travelling chest, and he knew the berserk would attack him if he saw him go to take them out. He had to act, though. This was a slight to his honour in front of everyone, and he couldn't let it go unpunished, even if he was sure he'd receive more in return than he was capable of handing out. He had only one course of action, one possible response. He swung a fist at the man's head. The man enveloped the blow under his arm and came up to join his hands at Vali's throat. The boy's arm was locked, and he was forced down, feet skidding for purchase on the ballast stones, but finding none. The berserk snarled into Vali's face and tightened his grip on his windpipe. Confrontation has a way of peeling back illusions and self-deceptions. Vali was no longer a man on his first raid, a prince of the Sword Hoarder, son of Orthon the Pitiless, who could trace his ancestry back to Odin himself, and the hope of a nation. He was a frightened boy, caught by a much bigger and stronger man. All he could focus on was the man's face, which seemed contorted with hate. He was choking Vali, and the boy's whole consciousness seemed to condense into trying to remove the hands from his neck, but he couldn't budge them. His vision seemed to contract to a tunnel. His head seemed ready to burst. Then a broad-bladed knife came into Vali's line of sight, but it was at such an angle that the berserk could not have been holding it. Something else came into view, a large pole with three iron rings fixed loosely about it by pegs. Both were interposed between him and the berserk.
"Save it for the enemy, Bodvar Bjarki," said a voice.
The berserk released his grip, and Vali lay back, gasping, his vision blurred. When he recovered his sight, he saw Bragi staring down the scarred man, the old warrior's knife pointing at the berserk's throat. There was the rattle of metal on metal, and a huge berserk in a brown bear pelt shoved that odd pole between the men. Bodvar Bjarki and Bragi said nothing, as hard men often don't in such circumstances. They just continued looking into each other's eyes. The brown bear berserk gently pushed Bjarki back down into his seat with the pole. The big man put his hands onto his oar. Bragi gave a short, amused snort and slid his knife back into its sheath. Then he sat back at his oar. Vali stood and climbed in across from him. Bragi turned to Vali, making no effort to keep his voice down so the berserk wouldn't hear.
"I told you the value of keeping your weapons close. If you'd had your knife, you could have gutted him."
Vali nodded. Embarrassment mingled with relief, but still, he thought, hadn't the situation resolved itself without anyone being gutted, for the moment anyway. If he'd had his knife, then the result might have been one dead berserk and a blood feud. Or worse, the berserk might have got the knife off him. Vali was aware that his strength in no way compared to that of the giant behind him. He glanced at the shore. Adisla was looking anxiously towards him. He inclined his head towards the big berserk and shrugged. Adisla mouthed, "Be careful," and he nodded in acknowledgement. After that, the men said nothing at all, just began to row out to sea, more for show than for effect, as the lines on the great sail were tightened and it pulled them out of the bay at an exhilarating pace. Vali raised his hand in goodbye to the people on the shore, saw the figures becoming smaller and smaller, and lost himself in the rhythm of the oars. The ship, which the Skalds called the Stallion of the Waves, really did feel like that. A living force, straining to get forward. For a moment, Vali almost forgot the brooding presence at his back. Then, against himself, he gave half a glance behind him. The disfigured man was staring directly at him. Or was he being silly? There wasn't really anywhere else for him to look. Bragi saw Vali's glance and turned to wink at the boy.
"Don't show me the man with the scars. Show me the man who put them there," he said.
Vali smiled. Bragi was a good man, he thought, who had his interests at heart. He was honest, big-hearted, straightforward and courageous. Vali just wished he found him less boring. The journey was to take 3 days. 3 days of dull stories, homely advice, and excruciating jokes from the old boy. In rescuing him from the berserk, Bragi had achieved a small victory. Vali should have had a knife on him, granted. But it was that, a small victory. It didn't imply, as Bragi seemed to with his told-you-so smile, that everything the old man said and believed was correct, and that he now had the right to patronize him for the foreseeable future. Vali thought of a trader he'd met 2 years before, Veles Libor from Rerik in the east, who was traveling up to see the whale people. Now he would have made a better mentor, had he stayed. He knew so much, had traveled the world in peace, not slaughter, and survived off his wits. With him, Vali felt inspired and eager to learn. He had spread out his scrolls, and Vali had been amazed to see the beautiful, colourful pictures and intriguing, squiggly writing. He had longed to find out how to read it, how to put down his thoughts in long waves of ink that rose, fell, and broke like the surf. Bragi, though, had nothing to teach him that he wanted to learn. The journey had been scouted the summer before. They skirted the coast north up nearly as far as the whale people, and then across west to the islands at the world's edge, which were no longer at the world's edge, but simply a staging post to the richer lands to the west. From there they sailed south and picked up the coast of the Westmen's land. Vali slept on the bottom of the boat, wedged in among the other men, listening to the mutterings and cursings of the berserks, looking up at the stars and thinking of Adisla. The berserks never bothered to speak to him, and he was glad of that, as it allowed him to remain in his own thoughts. His people saw no beauty in the sea. He thought of the names they gave it. Roarer, Empty Place, Devourer, Rager. To them it was an obstacle, a place of production and a killer. They turned the backs of their houses to the water, not wishing to look at it when they opened their doors. But Vali was enchanted by it. The sparkling greens and blues, the movement of the clouds on the horizon, the delight when a wave broke over the side of the ship and a mackerel landed in his lap. Then,
"The island! This is where it happens, boys!"
Vali glanced over his shoulder, but could see nothing. No land, no enemy. Bragi put a hand on his arm.
"Stick to the oar, lord. Don't worry about what's waiting for us when we get off the boat."
Vali nodded, aware that soon he would be killing his first enemy, or being killed himself. He wished he'd unpacked his sword already. He felt the need to piss, and stood to do so. He wasn't the only one. It was almost a comical sight, 10 men weeing over the side in one go, a like number on both accompanying Klaas, as if it was some sort of ritual. Vali scanned for land. All he could see was open sea. No, there was something. A flat, dark patch in the hazy distance. "This is it," he told himself. "This is it." The men pulled in their oars and laid them flat in the bottom of the longship. The berserk's leader, the man with the strange staff, piled up ballast stones. Then he took out some twigs and kindling and got a fire going on top of them. When it was established, he hung a cooking pot above it from a tripod and added water from a skin. Then he began throwing in things from a pouch. Vali went to the back of the ship and took his weapon from a barrel, along with his helmet. He was intensely nervous, and every movement felt unnatural, scrutinized by the men around him and found wanting. Other men were breaking open barrels and strapping on their war gear. There was no conversation. None of the berserks spoke to each other, but just mumbled into their beards, cursing and issuing threats to non-existent opponents. The contents of the firepot were poured into a large bowl, which was passed around, drained dry and refreshed. It came to Vali, and he looked inside to see a gritty soup. In it floated shriveled, spotty mushrooms that looked to him like human ears. He passed the bowl onto the berserk next to him without drinking, and watched as the man gulped at the brew. When each of the berserks had taken the soup, they took up their oars again. The warband leader made his way to the front of the ship, carrying the staff with the iron rings. He steadied himself by the prow as his men rowed and began to bang the staff on the boards of the ship, thumping out a clanging beat. The berserks responded to the rhythm by stamping their feet as they worked the oars.
"Odin!" shouted the leader.
As one, the berserks replied,
"That means fury! Odin! That means war!
"Oh, father!" screamed the leader.
"Mighty in battle!" came the reply.
"Oh, father!
Make red our swords!"